Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, September 18, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the implementation of the Obergefell decision. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very happy to have with us today three experts. They're going to be talking about the decision and how it's being implemented, how it should be implemented, what the limits are. We're going to hear in order first from Professor John C. Eastman. He's the director at the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence and the Henry Salvatori Professor of Law and Community Service at Chapman University Dale E. Fowler School of Law. He'll be followed in opening remarks by Professor Matthew J. Frank. He's the director in the William E. and Carol G. Simon Center on Religion and the Constitution at the Witherspoon Institute. And finally, we'll hear from Mr. M. Edward Whalen III. He is the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. They're going to each give opening remarks, and we'll have a little bit of back and forth between them. But by the 30 or 35-minute mark of our call today, we're going to try and get to audience questions, so please do be thinking of those questions. Gentlemen, very pleased to have you with us today. And with that, Professor Eastman, the floor is yours.
Dean, thanks very much, and thanks to my fellow panelists on this important call and to the Federalist Society for hosting us today. Obviously, on June 26th, the Supreme Court decided in Obergefell versus Hodges. It was actually four cases from Kentucky and Ohio and Michigan and Tennessee, all dealing with the validity of one man, one woman marriage laws in those states. And I'm going to kind of correct, I think, a description that we have on the definition of this call. It says the holding require states to issue marriage licenses to two people of the same sex. I don't think that's actually what it does, and herein lies a kind of a nature of the problem. It's said that a state that issues marriage licenses only to opposite-sex couples must also do so to same-sex couples. But that doesn't, of course, require the states to continue to issue marriage licenses at all. And striking down the existing statute, which is what the court did, rather leaves a void in the state law on what the rules on marriage are. So that kind of frames the understanding of what the executive and the legislative powers are versus what the judicial power is. Now, the immediate aftermath, of course, has now arisen when people who are in positions of having to try and implement this Supreme Court decision without any intervening guidance from their state legislature about whether the state is going to take the step of just, you know, not issuing marriage licenses at all and get out of the business altogether, or revising the forms and the requirements for the issuance of marriage laws licenses to comply with the Supreme Court's mandate. Of course, the most high-profile one is now Kim Davis in Rowan County, rural Kentucky. And what Ms. Davis has charged is not the broader challenge to the legality or the validity of the Supreme Court decision itself, although I think there is a great argument and deal of conversation to be had on that point, and Matt Frank is going to take that question of judicial supremacy up in a moment. Ms. Davis, the county clerk in Rowan County, was making a much more limited claim that even accepting the court's order that rather than just the invalidity of the Kentucky statute, that the Kentucky statute is effectively rewritten to require issuance of licenses to same-sex couples, that as the county clerk whose job it is to issue those licenses, a task for which she has a serious and sincerely held moral religious objection, does the state law, the State Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and since we're fighting this out now in the federal courts, that the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act require that her religious objection to this be accommodated. Now, some people have just said, well, how can she possibly have a religious objection to somebody else getting married? She's not the one entering into a same-sex marriage. And I think that kind of addresses the validity of her religious objection, which the courts are not supposed to get into, rather than the sincerity of her religious objection. And her religious objection is very important that we understand exactly what it is. It's that those licenses, contrary to her religious faith, are being issued under her authority. That's the mandate in Kentucky law, that the licenses be issued by the county clerk, not just with her signature. Other deputy clerks are allowed to sign. But whether it's on her signature or the deputy clerk's signature, the license says on its face that it is issued under her authority, and it's on her name, whether she signs it or not. And that's what she claims she cannot do. She's being asked to condone the issuance of a license and conduct that fundamentally violates her religious faith. And so the question is, under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, must she be accommodated in that? And so you have to begin with this proposition. Her religious exercise is being severely burdened. And then under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that government can force her to do that only if it has a compelling interest and the government's conduct is narrowly tailored to further that compelling interest. Well, what is the compelling interest? Well, the Supreme Court tells us the interest is in the same-sex couple being allowed to marry. Well, under Kentucky law, they can get a marriage license from any county in the state. And so they're not being deprived of a license to be married. They're just not being able to get Miss Davis to be the one that issues it under her authority. And they say, well, you know, that's a hassle for them to have to go to the next county over. And, you know, I leave it an open question factually whether that's true, particularly since they were sitting in the federal courthouse where right across the street was another county clerk's office. They could have easily walked across. So if this was really about their need to get a marriage license, they've had many opportunities to do so. But let's assume that they want or need, for whatever reason, to get the license issued from their home county, Rowan County. There's another provision of Kentucky law that specifically allows the county executive to issue the licenses on his authority if the county clerk is unavailable. And they didn't bother to try and get that either, which kind of manifests what's really going on here, which is not just the ability to get a license, but the ability to force every official to condone the issuance of that license, whether it's contrary to their religious faith or not. And the overlap and the parallel with, say, somebody like King Thomas More, who quietly acquiesced in the king's illegal marriage, in his view. But they demanded that he bend the knee to it, as he says, that he condone it and sign on to it. And that's where the religious conflict comes in. And under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, because there is that easy accommodation that neither the couples utilized nor the government in Kentucky utilized to accommodate Mrs. Davis's religious objection, then I think they're violating the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. But you see how the points of conflict now are arising as a result of the Supreme Court's decision. And like I say, Mrs. Davis's claim didn't even turn on the illegitimacy of the Supreme Court's decision. It rather turned on simply a statutory claim for religious accommodation that she's entitled to under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So with that, I think I'll stop there. I'm sure we may have some good questions about that aspect of the case. But in the meantime, let's shift it over to Matt Frank and can talk about, I think, the broader or grander issue, which is the legitimacy of the Supreme Court's decision itself and the whole question of judicial supremacy. Matt, over to you.
Thanks, John. That's a great setup for me. I appreciate it very much. I'm glad to be on this call, and I want to thank the Federalist Society and Dean and my colleagues and friends, John and Ed. And John has set it up very nicely with the Kim Davis situation, but as he rightly noted, she is not standing on her authority as an oath-taking officer under the federal and Kentucky constitutions to interpret the Constitution for herself, notwithstanding the Obergefell decision. But there are office holders who I think should consider doing so, who should consider pushing back strongly against the Obergefell ruling. I want to in a sense, reframe the discussion from compliance with Obergefell to resistance to it and the prospects of such resistance. And I'll begin by noting something really striking about all four of the dissents in the Obergefell decision by Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Alito, respectively. They all wrote separately. Most of them joined most of the others. But they seem to have agreed among themselves to call into question not just the legal reasoning, not just the use and abuse of judicial power that they see in this case, but the very legitimacy of the court's ruling. They do this in both subtle and not at all subtle ways. Subtly, all four of them, I noticed, almost invariably refrain from referring to what the court said or what Justice Kennedy said as the court speaking. They refer instead to the majority, which is, you know, a sort of interchangeable term with the court when the dissenters speak, but the consistency of it, of referring to it as the majority, a bare majority, five unelected lawyers, that kind of rhetoric is really striking. Chief Justice Roberts said, "Who do we think we are?" Referring to the five justices, and really all nine of them, if they're going to attempt this kind of rewrite of the Constitution and of the nation's marriage laws. Roberts also spoke of the majority's extravagant conception of judicial supremacy, and that's sort of my entry point for the nature of the problem here. Scalia as well spoke of the court overextending its power and risking being reminded of its own impotence. Alito spoke directly of this decision calling the very rule of law into question and signaling the failure of several decades of attempts to restrain the court. So I see that the four justices in the minority actually is issuing a kind of call to arms to American citizens and other public officials to resist Obergefell, to push back. Well, what would that take? It would take reminding ourselves that Charles Evans Hughes, to the contrary, notwithstanding, the Supreme Court does not dictate the meaning of the Constitution. We are under a Constitution, and it is not what the judges say it is. Public officials do not take an oath to the Constitution as defined by the Supreme Court. They take an oath to a real Constitution that they're all responsible for and responsible to. Now, John rightly framed this particular case as affecting the four states of the Sixth Circuit, which were directly under the Supreme Court ruling in Obergefell. What about the other 46? They're not parties to the case. Are they affected by it? We tend to think of Supreme Court rulings as the law of the land. Many people have said that the Supreme Court struck down all marriage laws that were not in line with its ruling, but technically, literally, it did not. Compliance or conformity with Obergefell in other states will depend, of course, on what public officials sworn to uphold the Constitution do in those states. But then we confront the fact that in our federal system, principles of federal supremacy come into play, and it's very difficult for states to push back against Supreme Court rulings or the federal judiciary generally. What would it take, therefore, for actual resistance of the kind I think the four dissenters are calling on American citizens to undertake? It would take national leadership. The institutions in the Supreme Court's weight class to punch back are the presidency and the Congress. Presidential leadership, as Keith Whittington of Princeton has written, is indispensable to challenges to judicial supremacy. But also congressional action may be required, some inquiry into matters of court process and jurisdiction. Fresh legislation on such matters could open up opportunities for states to challenge Obergefell. And over time, with the addition of new justices as vacancies occur, provide the four justices who dissented in Obergefell with a ripe opportunity, if joined by one or more new justices, to overturn this unconstitutional decision. That's the future I'm looking forward to, and that I want to foster conversations about bringing about. So with that, I'll turn things over to Ed Whalen.
Thanks very much, Matt. Well, look, I'd like to broaden our focus a bit to address the whole range of threats to religious liberty that I think we now face in the wake of Obergefell. Recall that perhaps the most revealing moment at oral argument in the case came when Solicitor General Don Verrilli candidly admitted, really volunteered, the nonprofit tax status of institutions that oppose same-sex marriage was, in his words, certainly going to be an issue. Likewise, religious schools that live out their beliefs will be threatened with discrimination lawsuits and the risk of losing their accreditation. Religious charities face being ineligible for government grants and contracts. And individual Americans who hold the same beliefs about marriage that President Obama professed when he was elected can expect to be penalized, marginalized, and stigmatized in multiple ways. So what we're seeing with the Kim Davis situation, what we've seen with wedding vendors, are only small but important skirmishes in the much broader battle that we're facing. And what I would like to highlight is the need for legislative protections sooner rather than later to protect against those threats. These are protections that are needed both at the federal and state levels to protect against action both by the federal government and by the states. Now, in Congress, we have pending the First Amendment Defense Act. It's been introduced in the Senate by Mike Lee and has a large number of co-sponsors. It's been introduced in the House by Raul Labrador. The bill would bar the federal government from discriminating in various ways against individuals and groups who adhere to the belief that marriage is a male-female union. But again, because the bill deals only with discriminatory actions by the federal government, similar legislation in the states is also necessary. Here I want to highlight, we had big battles over the last couple of years, battles that politically played out in rather ugly ways over state RFRAs, state religious freedom restoration acts. I want to emphasize here that state RFRAs are the wrong way to go to try to provide meaningful protection in the context of the clash between same-sex marriage and religious liberty. These RFRAs set forth a very general standard that judges will apply, and any protection they provide is highly uncertain and, of course, attainable only after costly litigation. Worse, efforts to enact RFRAs invite demagogic parades of horribles that, wild as they might be, are impossible to disprove precisely because the RFRAs are so vague. So one great advantage of the First Amendment Defense Act in Congress and similar bills being introduced in the states is that they focus the debate on carefully defined issues. You know, do the American people believe that groups should lose their tax-exempt status because they adhere to the understanding of marriage as a man and a woman? Do they believe that religious schools should be driven out of business? These are issues that we need to debate and fight and win on, and I think we can. It's going to take a while, obviously, to get at the federal level to get a president in office who will not veto such a bill, but progress can be made at the state level now, and I think, look, this isn't easy draftsmanship. It's hard when you have a ruling that has upset the foundational institution of American society to quickly draft legislation that deftly responds to all the challenges. So there will be disputes among people with goodwill about just how we should approach this, but I think that working these out in a constructive manner, we can get legislation like this passed. So that's what I want to emphasize in the broader picture. I agree with so much of what John and Matt have said. I just want to emphasize the most important thing going forward, I think, is to get legislation like the First Amendment Defense Act enacted in Congress and in the states. So with that, I will turn things back to Dean.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. I want to go back through the order once more and see if we have some responses one to another. But before I do that, let's open the floor to questions and people can begin queuing up. In a moment, we'll all hear the announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for any or even all of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So we've got a couple questions pending, but I do want to go back and check in with Professor Eastman and then Professor Frank. Responses, supplementations
sure,
of your response.
I want to pick up on Matt Frank's discussion on judicial supremacy a little bit, because I think that issue is as important as the marriage fight is. I think that issue is even much broader. And we've got to put it in context. Justice Scalia's dissent begins by citing Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 78, which describes the judiciary as the weakest branch, that they depend upon the executive, either the federal executive or the state executive, even for the efficacy of their judgments, which means that there was envisioned an executive check on illegitimate judicial decisions, that they would not be enforced. And when Justice Scalia then turns around and says, with each decision like this, where we ignore the Constitution and substitute our will for that of the people's will as manifested in the Constitution, we get that much closer to being reminded of our impotence, which means we get that much closer to being reminded that we can't do anything if the executive isn't going to enforce our decision. And it's that kind of response that is necessary, it seems to me, to prevent this notion that the judiciary is tyrannical and that it's completely unchecked and can do whatever it wants to do. Charles Evan Hughes famously said, the Constitution is supreme, but the Constitution is whatever the courts, whatever the judges say it is. Well, that's just not true. The Constitution is what it says it is, and it's supposed to be supreme even to the judiciary. And so challenging this notion of judicial supremacy rather than judicial review, rather than judicial faithful interpretation of the Constitution, I think is critically important if we're going to continue to live in a Republican form of government. And Abraham Lincoln's response to a similarly tyrannical decision by the Supreme Court in the Dred Scott case in 1957, his response in his first inaugural address is famous, and it's absolutely correct. He says, the decision of the court has to be binding on the parties to that action. But if we're to treat a judgment by the court on a contested issue of policy as deciding the matter forevermore, we will have ceased to that extent to be our own governors and will have handed over governing authority to that unelected body. We have to confront that very serious threat to our Constitution that is now manifested in a very big way in this case, as it was manifested a generation ago in Roe versus Wade, and a century ago in Plessy versus Ferguson, and a century and a half ago in Dred Scott. This is a serious problem, and we need to get some institutional check installed back on the judiciary to make sure it doesn't become the source of tyranny.
John, this is Matt Frank. I agree entirely with John. I will just say that it's, I recently read a book I alluded to in my opening remarks, political scientist Keith Whittington's book, The Political Foundations of Judicial Supremacy, which was published by Princeton University Press in 2007. And Keith notes that there is no sound basis for some automatic inference of judicial supremacy from the terms of the Constitution, that it had to be constructed over the last two centuries by the Supreme Court and other branches of government. But then, in a very sobering way, he explains that there's only been about a half a dozen presidents who have ever seriously challenged judicial supremacy. The bulwarks supporting it have grown over time, especially in the 20th century, in the last half century in particular, since the court declared its own supremacy in Cooper versus Aaron in 1958. And for the most part, the reason we have judicial supremacy today is because the other branches of government like it. The Congress supports it. Presidents, by and large, support it. They would really rather just dropkick constitutional issues to non-unelected, life-tenured lawyers to decide these very fraught and vital questions for the country and then just salute smartly and go forward with whatever the judges say. So it takes nowadays, I'm entirely on board with John, and I think we need a Lincoln-esque response to an out-of-control Supreme Court, which has really reached the nadir for the rule of law in Obergefell. But it's going to take uncommon courage. We just have to stare that reality in the face. It's going to take uncommon courage and wit to explain in a political culture that, as Justice Alito says, may be irremediably corrupted today, explain in that political culture and that legal culture what's wrong with judicial supremacy and why the political branches have to step up and take responsibility for the problem. It's going to take guts and brains.
Mr. Whalen, you want to take a minute?
Sure. Well, I agree with John and Matt, both that judicial supremacy is a serious misconception, and that it's a deep challenge to fight a misconception that is so widespread, so propagated by our law schools. I'll limit myself to this point. The distinct concept of judicial review, which unlike judicial supremacy, is actually supported by Marbury versus Madison, assumes and builds on the understanding that judges are doing genuine legal work. If you look at Hamilton's Federalist 78, his very justification there for judicial review understands judging as a craft. Well, when judges are just making it up, as they did in Obergefell, as they've done in some other major cases like Dred Scott and Roe, they undercut the very basis for judicial review. They delegitimate the courts, even having that responsibility. So, look, the task ahead is great. I will add that we the challenge will get even more daunting if we don't get a good president elected in 2016. Obviously, the composition of the court is open to change for the better or for the worse. We need to do what we can to change it for the better.
Very good. I want to turn to the audience momentarily. Before we do that, let me make our traditional commercial announcement. Next week, we've got a full slate of Teleforum conference calls. Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be talking about municipal broadband. Tuesday at noon, our first ever Teleforum conference call with a live audience, when we'll be hosting Teleforum from the offices of Covington and Burling, where Deb Garza will interview former FTC Commissioner Josh Wright. And then later next week, we'll be talking about the CFPB. We will revisit civil juries, and we'll have a separate Teleforum on class action litigation. Today, of course, we're talking about other matters. We've got three questions pending. If you'd like to join that queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. And now let's take our first question of the day.
Hi, am I on?
You are. We can hear you fine.
Okay, great. This is Dale Carpenter. I teach at the University of Minnesota Law School, and I'm the chapter advisor for the Federalist Society here. And I have a great deal of respect for all three of the speakers that you chose today, and this is obviously a very important and timely subject. And my question may not be for the speakers, but rather for the organizers, and that is, why was the decision made not to include people who are more friendly to the decision in this conference call? As you know, there's a wide variety of views on this issue in the society, and it's been my understanding that the society tries to avoid the appearance of taking one position on it.
Well, this is Dean. I appreciate your call, Mr. Carpenter, and welcome you to the call. We actually discussed the fact in our pre-call, the fact that we didn't have a lot of disagreement among our panelists. And you're right, the Federalist Society does pride itself and considers it a hallmark that we usually put together programs that have a lot of disagreement, have a lot of discussion, and a lot of fireworks for our audience. And the view here is that the truth will emerge from those sorts of discussions. I'd welcome any critical questions or comments you'd have to offer here for us today. And the questions I was going to ask of our panelists today, if we get through all the audience questions, were designed to challenge their views in the absence of that sort of opposing voice among the panelists. But Mr. Carpenter, you have a question you want to direct to the panelists that challenge their views, or even a statement you want to make?
Well, no, I appreciate that. I don't think that every forum has to be perfectly balanced or anything. It would have seemed to me to have one. You could find one, and I just would offer my services if you want to do one in the future in which someone might have a divergent perspective, but I'll yield the floor to others who have questions at this point.
And Dean, if I may, I just want to thank Professor Carpenter, I think, for the way he has, I think, responsibly engaged in debate on this broader issue. I think he's been, you know, he's been a real example. So I'm thankful for that. You know, I would hope that we do have opportunities to discuss and debate.
We'll make sure to do that. Let's carry on then with another question. We still have three questions pending, so let's take another call.
Hi, Larry Callahan. Let's put this in the opposite situation. Suppose you had a clerk that was going to do something that you, instead of refusing to do something that you disagree with, refuses to do something that you agree with. What are the remedies? Secondly, in the court situation, how is this different than, let's say, an Article III judge who's not answerable to anyone at all, saying that he or she, for example, in a criminal case where there's a mandatory criminal sentence, like some Title 21 case, saying, under no circumstances am I going to impose that sentence. Well, there is you can impeach the Article III judge, and not an easy process. Are there any other remedies under those two circumstances?
Hi, Larry. This is John Eastman. I'll take that up first. Let me start with the second question first. I think the founders envisioned a much more robust impeachment authority for judges than we've come to rely on. Right now, the view, and it has been this way since the failed attempt to impeach Samuel Chase in 1803, right now the view is that only criminal conduct of a serious nature unrelated to judicial duties are grounds for impeachment. Well, I think that turns it upside down. I think the founders would have envisioned an impeachment authority when they do the kind of thing you've said that they're doing, that is, you know, willfully not complying with the law and the Constitution that's supposed to govern their judicial decision making. That was a greater threat to the body politic, and therefore more in need of an impeachment proceeding than committing, you know, some robbery across the street. And so we've gotten this notion of the impeachment, which was designed to be a check on the judiciary, from lawlessness in the conduct of their office. We've lost that. And absent getting that back, I think it's a very difficult proposition to keep the judiciary in check. Now, Senator Cruz held a hearing in July exploring other types of remedies to get this balance, this checks and balances, back in line a little bit. He had suggested term limits for justices. I proposed a couple of other things. You know, a supermajority vote in Congress to override an erroneous Supreme Court decision, or a decision that intrudes on core authority of the states and violates federalism principles. The ability to override that with the majority of the states. Neither of those things would be easy to accomplish. In fact, they might not ever be accomplished, but the fact that such a check existed might have a salutary effect, even absent ever having to be used. So I think those kind of things have to be considered if we're going to get this checks and balances structural constitution back in line. And as Matt said, one of the ways you start moving the ball on that conversation is national leadership. How would you do it? Well, you could have a presidential candidate talking about these things. You could have an act of Congress that disavows the Supreme Court's decision, removes jurisdiction, appellate jurisdiction from the Supreme Court, and trial level litigation from the lower federal courts for considering new marriage issues. And then when a claim is brought in Alabama or is brought in Kentucky, I mean not Oklahoma or what have you, and those clerks are refusing to issue marriage licenses, then there would be no federal court outlet to decide the matter. And you know, so these kind of things, this concerted effort to respond to an illegitimate decision, it seems to me the only way to get back this notion that the judiciary is not, you know, kind of a group of philosophers' kings running our lives.
Dean, if I may respond to the first question the caller asked, which is, I think, is an important one, basically asking us to make sure that we are testing our principles against different fact situations. Happy to do that. Let's say that there's a jurisdiction in which some sort of gun permit needs to be issued, and there's some sort of clerk who has religious objections to issuing a gun permit. Well, it seems to me there should be some sort of accommodation. If that's just a small part of the person's job, I have no difficulty at all with that person being accommodated. Similarly, you know, in the whole wedding vendor context, I think we've had these non-discrimination norms metastasize in a way that basically treats private individuals operating commercial businesses as though they're public utilities. I think that's a very dangerous trend, and I have a lot of sympathy for the libertarian critique that Richard Epstein and others have offered of such a regime. So, yes, we need to make sure that our principles aren't being driven by our policy preferences in a particular area. Here, I think that's not a difficult challenge to meet.
But that's exactly the problem. With the gun permit is a perfect example. You have a clerk that is empowered, and that's the judicial or quasi-judicial authority that has the authority to issue or not issue a gun permit. They check to see you have the licensing, you've played the fees, you don't have a criminal record, whatever, and that person says, nope, I'm not going to issue gun permits because that's not how I read the Second Amendment or whatever.
So someone else, that person steps aside, someone else in the office does it.
Pardon me?
So that person steps aside, someone else in the office does it. That's sort of accommodation, which is routinely allowed under Title VII, and it seems to me what's called for under the state RFRA strikes me as non-controversial.
But this woman is refusing to step aside and doesn't think it's appropriate.
This is Matt Frank. Maybe now we'll unearth a little disagreement among the panelists on this call. I'm a bit more ambivalent about the Kim Davis situation than John is. I'm not sure exactly where Ed is, but I'm not sure that federal RFRA covers her in the circumstances here. It might. I'm not as certain of that as John is. Kentucky RFRA is an issue that the Sixth Circuit the other day essentially punted on and said that I think, if I understood them correctly, that fresh litigation in state courts would be required to interpret the relatively new and so far not much interpreted Kentucky RFRA. Kim Davis is an elected official and so is not covered by religious accommodations employment statutes at the federal level, explicitly not covered, as Eugene Volokh has pointed out at the Volokh conspiracy. And the caller is right. You know, she so far has not requested the kind of accommodation which would simply shift responsibility to another in the office. She has simply shut down the issuance of all marriage licenses for couples of opposite sex, opposite sex or same-sex couples.
Pardon me. Yeah. I believe, and there have been so many different accounts of this, it's hard to know exactly what was the case, but
yeah.
I believe that her objection was to having her name
I understand.
On the licenses.
No,
I had thought that she was, perhaps her position evolved during the litigation. So again,
that's absolutely correct characterization, Ed. But she's rather in a quandary where her religious conscience, with which I'm fully in sympathy, stands on one side of the problem, and on the other side, a Kentucky statute that requires that the marriage licenses be issued and read in a certain way. I think Governor Beshear has a responsibility here, as 57 other county clerks out of the 120 counties of Kentucky have asked him to do, to call a special session of the Kentucky legislature to write religious accommodations laws of the kind that North Carolina recently did to take care of this problem. I'm sympathetic to Kim Davis. I just think that she's in a legal pickle that's very difficult for her to get out of, and I'm actually kind of sympathetic to Judge Bunning too, who felt obliged to jail her on contempt charges. You know, should she resign her office? Well, do we really want to say that people with conscientious religious scruples about the meaning of marriage are simply unfit to serve in public office with responsibilities where marriage law is concerned? I don't think the country wants to say that exactly. So this is a problem that the Supreme Court's making. And I want to applaud Kim Davis for calling our attention to a very real and acute problem, and I give her I give her thanks for her courage. But she's really calling attention to a legal problem that others are going to have to solve, and I'm not sure is soluble within the four corners of existing religious accommodations laws, state or federal.
But this highlights, I think, the problem of the Supreme Court's decision, which leaves a void. In striking down the statute, we're left with the question, well, what does the new marriage regime in that state look like? Does it look like the state doesn't issue marriage licenses at all? Does it look like an authority to rewrite the statutorily required form? Does it lead to a judicial rewriting of the accommodation or the exemption for individual clerks? It's a wide open vista of what the lawmaking that is required to put back in place the regime that has now been struck down, and the legislatures have not done it, and so are the courts just going to become our de facto legislatures? And that, Kim Davis has said, I'd be happy to have the marriage licenses issued out of my office as long as they don't say they're issued on my authority, which is what the statute requires in Kentucky. So will the judge just say, okay, well, we don't like that language, so we're now going to legislate from the bench and say, okay, it is issued on the authority of the court? Where do we say that the court has exceeded its judicial power and is now taking on court legislative powers in a very problematic way? And to go back to the gun example that our caller Larry Callahan raised, Larry, I think the direct parallel with the Kim Davis situation is if somebody says, I have a religious objection to issuing gun licenses or having them issued on my authority, but somebody else in the office can, and it's not issued on my authority, I could be accommodated in that way. If it turns out that there is no way to accommodate, now under the kind of religious freedom model, that would now create a compelling governmental interest to force the only office holder who can issue that license to do so. And she may well lose her religious claim in that circumstance, just as Mrs. Davis may lose a religious claim if there is no alternative to providing the marriage license other than her issuing it. That would then be a compelling interest and narrowly tailored. But we don't have that in the Kentucky case, and I think that's why there's much more merit to her RFRA contention than Judge Bunning acknowledged in his decision.
Thanks, John. Great.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got almost 20 minutes left, and we've got four questions pending.
Hi, Dean. Hi, everyone on the call. This is Will Hahn. I just had a question for all the panelists in light of some of the comments. I fully appreciate the critiques of judicial supremacy here and the need for what Professor Frank called a Lincoln-esque response, but I am curious about what persons or entities can rightfully invoke that type of response. Professor Frank suggested that an institution within the court's weight class should respond, namely the president or the Congress. And it sounds like Professor Eastman agrees with that, but considering some of the comments of Mike Huckabee and others, it appears to some that Lincoln's position on Dred Scott means not simply that citizens can be accommodated from decisions that they disagree with, but that any citizen can simply reject any Supreme Court decision they disagree with. And then there has to be a principled basis to distinguish Lincoln and Dred Scott and say the Montana Supreme Court rejecting applying Citizens United or various localities that have tried to get around the Heller and McDonald decisions. And so I'm wondering if that distinction is departmentalism. The president or Congress, if not parties to the case, can act on their own conclusions about the correctness of a Supreme Court decision as a separate and co-equal branch of government charged with the policy of government. But how does that principle apply beyond that without opening the door to a selective application of Supreme Court precedent?
If I may, this is Matt Frank. I'll tackle Will Hunt's question. Thanks for that question. It's really nicely framed. I do think that Mike Huckabee may have spoken on this subject rather too carelessly and open-endedly. I don't think that challenging judicial supremacy is the same thing as opening up a sort of wild, wild west of anybody gets to act on his own understanding of the Constitution under any circumstances, even when there are relevant judicial decrees and orders, affecting him in the function of his official capacity. I led off by saying that Obergefell literally affects only the four states of the Sixth Circuit. And that, of course, affects Kim Davis, who's in Kentucky and is directly under the orders of Judge Bunning. And whether Judge Bunning is getting the issues rightly or wrongly, she's under his thumb, and he has a kind of authority over her. But I think that a public official in, say, Mississippi might push back and see if this can all be reopened. When people come under the proper jurisdiction and proper authority of a court, and it issues a legal order to them, I think Lincoln himself would say they're obliged to obey. We were obliged to continue considering Dred Scott a slave because the Supreme Court said he was still a slave. But we could not be bound by that in our policymaking or in considering the ruling's impact on other parties beyond the parties to the actual case, to the actual litigation. So I think that's the beginning of an approach here. I think it would be good to try and engineer through legislation and through executive action and the separation of powers opportunities for public officials in other states to push back on this and give the Supreme Court an opportunity, perhaps an obligation, to reconsider Obergefell.
If I may, Ed here, apart from the mistaken conception of judicial supremacy, our legal institutions have given so much power to the courts to entrench their view that there is a practical judicial supremacy that operates anyway. And obviously, anyone who defies either not just the Supreme Court ruling, but the precedential sweep of that, is likely to be dragged into court and face an order, as Kim Davis did, and face jail time. So I don't think we have to worry about a wild, wild west situation. I think even when you set aside the misconception of judicial supremacy, in our current system, the courts have tremendous power to entrench their view. I don't think the departmentalist approach can work, especially whereas here you're talking about a Supreme Court intrusion on state authority. It would be strange if the only actors who could stand up to the court were federal actors who, would see themselves as having no stake in it. So I suppose I'm not so sure that I'm concerned. Yes, things could, in theory, get very, very messy if everyone doesn't kowtow to the court. Well, there are worse things than messiness, and I think that the very fact that messiness can result ought to put a greater obligation on the Supreme Court to get things right in the first place and not to be so reckless.
Yeah, and this is John Eastman. Let me add there. It's a question of prudence. To borrow the language of the Declaration of Independence, we ought not to engage in such conduct for light and transient causes. So just because we disagree with a normal Supreme Court decision in the ordinary course of things, ought not to give anybody ground to act in the way that Kim Davis has been acting here. The question is, are there cases that rise to such a level, that are such a threat to the very understanding of the rule of law and the Constitution, and undermine the very basic notions of society, as I believe this decision does, as Lincoln believed Dred Scott did, as many of us continue to believe that Roe versus Wade did, then it seems to me it's not just permissible, but obligatory on citizens to react in the way that Kim Davis has done here. And that's not just the co-equal branches at the federal level, although politically, in order to get any traction for this, you're going to have leadership at that level as well. But I think, quite frankly, the states in this narrow class of cases, so we're not talking about state nullification, we're not talking about reviving Calhounism, but in this narrow class of cases where the court has manifestly usurped power imposed a rule with by diktat, and you know, and that's the kind of language that the defense use here. I'm not making this up. Then it seems to me that states ought to react as well. And our example there is the Wisconsin Supreme Court when it confronted the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act, which, you know, the Constitution protects Southern slave owners in the return of their fugitive slaves, undoubtedly. But the longstanding Fugitive Slave Act before the 1850 modification had due process protection so that somebody who was actually free didn't get erroneously returned to slavery. And that those due process protections are removed in the 1850 Act, and it's patently unconstitutional what the Congress had done there. So held the Wisconsin Supreme Court. When the U.S. Supreme Court overrode that decision, that was a patently illegitimate decision of the court. And to this day, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has not entered the U.S. Supreme Court's mandate on its books. So firm it was in its rejection and opposition to that decision. I think in those extraordinary cases like that, that's the kind of response that we ought to expect if we're going to withstand this claim of judicial supremacy, whether it's boldly made or whether it just kind of ossifies into that understanding as it has in the last century.
I want to try and get to as many of these questions as possible. We've got four pending, so I'm going to ask the callers to be as concise as they can.
This is David Applegate with the Chicago Lawyers Chapter. I'd like to pick up on something that Professor Dale Carpenter of the University of Minnesota said earlier. Some years ago, Professor Carpenter and I were on the same side of a Chicago Lawyers Chapter Federalist Society debate on gay marriage, in which Doug Kamek was opposed, and Professor Carpenter and I, among others, were in favor. In view of Professor Carpenter's comments earlier on this call, I do not understand this call to be about the merits or demerits of same-sex marriage, but about the legitimacy of this particular decision of the Supreme Court. And with that in mind, I'd like to ask any of the speakers if they can distill into a single sentence or proposition the constitutional principle for which they think the majority decision in Obergefell actually stands.
Great question. Ed here. Well, of course, it's a classic Kennedy opinion, so I think it's difficult to distill anything into a coherent sentence or even a coherent paragraph. Look, it was Kennedy who, in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, said that at the heart of liberty is the ability to define the concept of one's own existence, et cetera, et cetera. He thinks he's a grand moral philosopher who can define what liberty means, and that's his power. So, I think the majority opinion stands, as the Chief Justice put it, for an extravagant conception of judicial supremacy.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I mean, even if you try and parse the analysis, so for example, the liberty, the notion that liberty obligates the government to confer a benefit rather than preventing the government from interfering with your conduct, that, of course, challenged to Justice Kennedy's analysis or his opinion is raised by in Justice Thomas's dissent, and there's no response to it. There's no analysis under equal protection other than to say equal protection supports what I've just done under due process.
Right.
The government itself disavowed pushing the equal protection thing, and I think with good reason. Our equal protection analysis requires that we treat people who are similarly situated similarly. And, of course, same-sex couples and opposite-sex couples are not similarly situated with respect to one of the core purposes of marriage, which is the channeling of the unique procreative abilities of men and women. So you know, the opinion is unbelievably weak in any analysis. It's hard to, therefore, ascertain what kind of constitutional principle comes out of it, other than we've got five votes to override the votes of 50 million Americans and the core societal institution across the country and across human history. And that's an unbelievable claim of well beyond judicial supremacy to, quite frankly, judicial tyranny. We will it, and we are going to do it. It could have been a short opinion. It could have been like the pharaohs of ancient Egypt, right? Let it be spoken, let it be done. And that's about as close of an analysis you can get for actually a legal principle that comes out of the decision.
This is Matt Frank. Yeah, I agree with what's just been said, and I'll say that given the fact that this is a fairly ripe opinion by Justice Kennedy, and even more than usually gaseous performance on his part, he actually got some help from the dissenters in bringing things to a sharp point. And Chief Justice Roberts stated the gravamen of the decision much more succinctly than Kennedy ever could when he said in his dissent, "The truth is that today's decision rests on nothing more than the majority's own conviction that same-sex couples should be allowed to marry because they want to." And that, quoting Kennedy now, Roberts goes on, "it would disparage their choices and diminish their personhood to deny them this right." End of quote of Kennedy by Roberts. Roberts then said, "Whatever force that belief may have as a matter of moral philosophy, it has no more basis in the Constitution than did the naked policy preferences adopted in Lochner." Now, John Eastman and I actually have a disagreement about Lochner. We can air out on another occasion, but you get Roberts's point. This is, as he said elsewhere, an act of will and not of judgment. And they get to marry because they want to seems to be the gist of the Kennedy opinion.
Running short on time here, we still have some questions pending, so let's take another call.
Hi, this is Andrew Kloster with the Heritage Foundation. So I have a quick question. So we've talked a lot about sort of the ability of people to object if they're in a government position, but I'm curious about what ability there is to object or even obligation to object to a judgment, even if you're a same-sex marriage supporter, when the reasoning is really, really bad. So I'm thinking, like, if there's a criminal law that I think is inappropriately applied to a defendant and the guy ends up getting acquitted on the basis of, let's say, his race, you know, you're not going to be convicted because you're white or black or whatever. And I'd like to think that even if I were the defendant, I'd say, you know, send me to jail. That reasoning is just so bad, I can't agree with the judgment. So I guess I'm curious, just how bad does reasoning need to be before someone who supports gay marriage will say, and this might go back to what was just said in the response that Professor Frank had, just how bad does the reasoning need to be before you realize it's a dangerous opinion that could affect liberty in other areas and you'd object even to the judgment?
Yeah, if I may, this is Matt Frank. I guess I can try to field that. John Eastman said earlier this is a judgment of prudence, and I'm not sure I can offer any set of rules or rubrics that would enable you on every occasion to know exactly how outrageous an opinion is. But there are certain interesting markers here. Obergefell came as the culmination of a 20-year struggle that began with lower court rulings in Alaska and Hawaii in the mid-1990s, prompting the first wave of constitutional amendments in the states, then DOMA, then after Lawrence versus Texas and the Goodrich decision in Massachusetts, more constitutional amendments, and, you know, then the brouhaha in California, followed by Prop 8, followed by Judge Walker's kangaroo trial. You know, the Supreme Court, in other words, has had ample notice that the American people really care about this, that they're really divided about this, that a substantial part of the population and the legal community, as in, they were informed in scores of briefs, believe that this kind of lawmaking that they just engaged in is fundamentally illegitimate. We have the virtual call to resistance from the four dissenters, is again not just disagreeing but calling the legitimacy of the ruling into question. And then finally, the really striking thing that all the justices call attention to the religious liberty issue in a case that in itself has nothing to do with religious liberty. Now, why do they bring it up? Because they all understand the horrible quagmire into which this decision pitches the country. And Kennedy himself talks about the religious liberty issue because he felt constrained to respond to those remarks of the dissenters. I think when you put all those things together and you see that one of the country's fundamental social institutions, perhaps the most fundamental social institution, the family, has been placed under a dire threat by the Supreme Court, then a judgment of prudence here becomes much easier.
Well, Andrew, if I understood your question, and perhaps I didn't, this is Ed here, I don't think it's fair to fault supporters of same-sex marriage for not vigorously, distancing themselves from the opinion. And I say that just as a matter of human nature. You put the shoe on the other foot. It's only understandable that they would welcome the victory just as, you know, we would welcome, an undeserved victory. Now, when you add to that many of them, I think, sincerely believe that the bottom line victory isn't undeserved, even if their, you know, reasoning isn't the way they would put it, I think there's all the less reason to fault them. Now, of course, one would hope that we would all have the courage to, you know, criticize wrongly reasoned opinions, even if they benefit us. But I, again, human nature being what it is, I think that's a bit much to ask of folks generally.
Hear, hear.
We've told by our speakers they can go a minute or two longer. Let's see if we can take at least one more question.
Hi, this is David Forte. How are you guys?
Hi, David.
Hi. There's no doubt that this probably is the most extreme judicial diktat in our history. I have a couple of statistics for you. Before the Windsor case, nine states had voted for same-sex marriage, and three court decisions had enforced it. And one state voted it to ratify a court decision. After Kennedy gave the green light in Windsor, you had 21 court decisions legalizing gay marriage, and only two by statute. Now, there's no doubt that the political process was turning in favor of those who were in favor of same-sex marriage. But this theft is what Roberts, I think, particularly talks about. This theft of the democratic process is particularly egregious, and the total lack of any reasoning is not par for the course. It's worse than the course. So the fault of this decision cannot be exaggerated. But in the discussions I've had with John, I just want to bring up once more that the remedy has to be something much more measured, and we can't just flail about. For one thing, judicial supremacy was not a grab, as the progressivists claimed in the 30s, of the court. It is piggybacked on the respect for the rule of law, without which this country never would have had a revolution, and without which this country would not exist, considering our genuine diversity. So the respect for the rule of law is what carries this court. It's not its arrogance. It piggybacks on that. And we have to make sure that we don't lose that we are a self-governing nation because of the respect of the rule of law. And although John just answered a discussion that we had off on our own regarding state nullification, I think we have to worry about making too much of Lincoln's Dred Scott and not make it a permission, just as John says, to say no to everything. But we have to have a limiting principle as to at what point and in what structural check do we develop to contain egregious cases without losing the respect for the rule of law and without upsetting the structure altogether.
David, this is John. I appreciate that enlightening comment and question. Let me offer as a model Martin Luther King in his letter from Birmingham Jail. By challenging the decision of the court as illegitimate and being willing to go to jail in order to highlight the importance of the issue, I think kind of is the trigger level that we need to talk about. And Martin Luther King does the same thing. I violated the state law requirement that I get a permit in order to march in protest for the segregation and the lunch counters in Birmingham. And I'm willing to do so because of the unjustness of that law. And to call attention to the unjustness of that law, I'm sitting here in the jailhouse in Birmingham. And it seems to me it's that, you know, when you get an issue that rises to the level where people are willing to do that, our existing structures ought to get the court to revisit it. But this court instead, when they get that kind of opposition to them, and this is the significance of the Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision, where Justice Kennedy and Souter and O'Connor write, it's precisely when we get that objection from the people, who are, quite frankly, the ultimate sovereign in the country, that we ought to double down and stay firm in our illegitimate decision, otherwise we're questioning the rule of law. That seems to me to have turned up the very notion of sovereignty upside down. And we can't let it lie, because then we no longer have a rule of law, because we just have a rule of imposition of diktats from the court. And where you make that dividing line is a tough call, but it seems to me it has to exist in some very small subset of cases.
And this I second you, John. I just gave a Constitution Day speech on the worst decision in the country's history, which is Obergefell. And my argument was this: if we look at all the other worst decisions, Dred Scott, Plessy, Lochner, if you want to include that, Casey and Roe together, all of them left some space for the political process still to work. All of them left it. Look at the space that we have had in the pro-life movement. It hasn't been much, but we've carried the day morally because of that. This decision leaves no space for the political process to work. How can a state favor heterosexual marriage over homosexual marriage? It'll be thrown out as invidious discrimination right from the get-go. There's just no space, and so we have to craft a response that fits this but maintains the rule of law and the structure of our Constitution.
David, I think that's a fitting coda to our conversation today. I agree entirely with you. This is Matt Frank about maintaining the rule of law. But we do. You're right. We do have to think about crafting responses that are themselves conformed to the rule of law, but that reopen that space that the Supreme Court has closed.
I am afraid we're going to have to leave it right there. I want to thank each of our speakers. We certainly appreciate you joining us and extending the time for this call as our audience continue to be engaged. I want to thank the audience as well for joining us and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is Monday at 1 o'clock Eastern Time, when we'll be talking about Muni Broadband. But until that next Teleforum call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.